As a performer, your body is there.
Hi, I'm Mad Kate, and you're listening to Sweat, Sexuality, Work, Extraction, Art, Theatrics. Sweat is a series of conversations about performance and performativity of the sexual and sexualized body at work, where work is broadly defined as the labor of survival, the labor of care, creativity, and capital A art. How exactly do we define our work? And how does that work entangle and circumscribe our sexual identities, our creative lives, and the ways in which we provide care? How do we perform tasks, acts of care, and identities? Anchored in our always already racialized and sexualized bodies, our complex intersectionalities, these conversations are a means of relating through work to each other. I hope that they contribute to dialogues which normalize sex work as work and all work as deserving of respect, healthy conditions, and a living wage.
The working ethos that we share with my colleagues is that it's just not about us. It's about something else. That might be the pursuit to find social justice, but also the joy of doing it and looking for it through experience, through practices of others, through creative joy, intellectual joy, and that this is not only reserved for a privileged class.
Welcome. Today's conversation is with editor and curator Maria Inés Plazo Lasso, who in 2018 founded, together with Paul Zohatsky, the multilingual street newspaper for art and society, wealth and poverty called Arts of the Working Class.
What are these forms of asymmetric symbiosis between wealth and poverty, arts and society?
Maria Inés writes for the paper and allied publications, edits pieces individually and collectively, sells advertisement spots according to each issue's topics and interests, talks constantly with vendors, contributors, and potential collaborators, curates exhibitions related to the overarching concerns shared in Arts of the Working Class, gives lectures in different universities and academies such as the New Center, brings stacks of Arts of the Working Class to different cities such as LA, New York, Quito, or Barcelona, and takes care of the project and the people around it as a publisher. She currently lives in and works from Düsseldorf, preferably in trains.
So maybe there is no clear one single reason for this, but many. And so I will choose for today a first, maybe a more anecdotic entrance to why we're doing this. It's the year 2017, and Paul Zohatsky and I meet in Berlin. And I am invited to curate or organize together with him his exhibition, a solo show that he is to present during the very popular festival of galleries in Berlin, commercial ones called Gallery Weekend. And knowing that this is a crucial moment for city, not only dealers or artists, but also curators and institutions. Yes, arts, especially from the visual arts, to come to Berlin and interact and exchange currencies. And I will come back to that later, not only financial currencies. It was important for us to make something that was not only self-reflexive, basically producing something within an exhibition that responds to a major frame, but rather like really go deep down into a systemic question about how art actually impacts a city, and not only in a Debordian way, saying, you know, the what kind of spectacles a city bears, but rather what are the complications that come along with it. And back then we considered Berlin an imploded city, a city that back then it was not only, I constantly say, I'm repeating myself and well, like constant in saying back then, but it's already 6 years ago.
Mm.
And gentrification wasn't hitting that visibly. But galleries started to close, artists starting to move out of the city, and scarcity came to also infiltrate itself. This is how we titled the first issue of a paper that we never really planned as something to come out periodically or to have a long-term horizon, but we titled it A City is a Stateless Mind. Stateless as a matter of fact regarding national borders and the trade between national values and entities in a city like this, historically speaking, very intertwined with wars and ideological clashes, but also as stateless as in a constant state of awe and overwhelming stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So I remember sitting in the train on my way to the gallery and looking at the vendor in the U-Bahn and the metro selling moths and realizing that this paper that was being sold, this has been there for like since the 80s.
Uh-huh.
It's the end of the 80s.
It was another street paper?
Yes. So the person that was selling this paper for me was like very related to maybe a deja vu or a recent memory that was just too fresh in my mind. And I thought it is as if we both just went out of Berghain. And I just went to, you know, I just went to start my week in a gallery with a really little pay without any worker as fair working conditions. And this person is just selling this. I felt my empathy was just overwhelmingly big in that moment. So,
like in the sense that you felt the privilege of metaphorically coming out of Berghain, is that what you mean?
I don't think it's necessary privilege. I think there is a certain need that is entangled with this specific space that I'm mentioning. So, the city of Berlin is a city of clubbing. Has a very specific cultural connotation to that, to the form and that topography of freedom. And I think that in that moment was considering not only topography, but also an icon of the city. So like we both feel attracted to Berlin thanks to these places. And then to make a living in Berlin has just become increasingly impossible. Because Berghain is there as a moment, like appears as a moment where the city was empty, right? So the city was empty. It was possible to experiment with sound, with music, you know, graffiti. And suddenly this is just gone or just commodified.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, this was a very, maybe this is a why, saying like we all need the same access to spaces. And this is a question that we tried to answer with founding a newspaper that would tackle exactly this, but not only operate in the sense of a street newspaper as since the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, when neoliberalism takes over ideologically and systemically. So structures begin to change, and now we're cutting them. And Arts of the Working Class it's not a product that repeats the, let's say, apologetic ways of saying, well, you know, this society now, the capitalist, neoliberalist one, is unfair. So these are the measurements to survive, but rather to unveil what are these forms of asymmetric symbiosis between wealth and poverty, arts and society. And that this is what we always say this street newspaper is. It's a street newspaper, a multilingual one that comes out 5 times a year, bi-monthly-ish, that it's addressing all of this all the time in a cacophony of states of mind or statelessness,
mm-hmm.
focusing on different poetics, semantics, questions, facts that are constantly, yeah, making us busy in a sense of urgency. And it's really bothering me to say this, and at the same time I don't think there is a other way to put it, but the sense of urgency in which Arts of the Working Class was born is still there,
mm-hmm.
and makes us feel that our paper it's a crucial crossroad for many struggles and also many possibilities of change and joy and questioning and most of all ways of arguing, ways of sharing criticality that no longer exists or appears or appeals to a quote-unquote mainstream.
What's the relationship between the people who are selling the paper? As I understand it, they are able to take the income from selling it.
Right.
100%, right?
100%.
What's the relationship between them and those who are contributors, who are writers?
So specifically to the writers and the vendors, I cannot give you whether statistics or a clear answer either, as most of our contributors do not come by commission or by a call, but rather are constantly people that come together, people that like the paper and would like to contribute, or are people that are invited by others, since we have worked since the very beginning with associate editors and guest editors that think along with us what could be a good issue at the very specific time. Whilst vendors, that is exactly the same. So we're not a foundation. There's no foundation or a stable structure behind us that would allow us to control the flow of exchange of the paper. So we don't know the vendors personally, mostly. We don't also know who is selling the paper. And we are aware of the dangers and what this represents. But there is an informality, there's an anarchism in that, and also a scalable sense of sharing that goes also beyond our own precarity and possibilities, that this paper, something that it's not, you know, it's not us as the matrix and everybody around it, but rather to be formed more rhizomatically. So specifically in the sense of distribution and contribution, everybody can sell the paper. We started printing 10,000 copies back then. We now print 75,000.
Wow.
So that's a volume. We what we call core team of 4 to 5 people, it's just impossible to tame. So there is a relationability around many of the issues that everybody is welcome to tackle. Everybody's welcome to contribute. Everybody's welcome to sell the paper, do whatever they want with it. If there is the interest also in having a conversation with us.
How do they get a hold of it to sell it? How is your distribution?
Currently, we have over 10 pickup stations in Berlin. We started actually stacking the street newspapers in different cellars across Berlin. And we would have a hotline, which is, back then was my private number. So everybody could call.
Wow.
Everybody could call. Yes, that was pretty punk. Everybody could call and say, hey, I want a stack. Where can I get it? So back then, I think I carried with me so many stacks. I would have a day job, so I would take it with me, and any vendor could, you know, ring and say, hi, I'm here to pick up Maria's stack. So I would give this to them.
That's great.
Paul, or back then we had a wonderful person that joined the collective, Hallie Frost, who decided to also, you know, interview the few vendors that back then were passing by the gallery or whatever we were working at the time. Or Paul would drive around with his car and distribute papers. That was crazy. Now it's Paul, the artist, Paul Sohatsky, who I started this, would do this also very systematically. This is just has changed very rapidly because we need a storage. We need to take care of not only the stacks that go to different pickup stations. Some of them are anonymous, so we have to constantly be in exchange with people that can take care of the so-called pickup stations. There are also clandestine places that have established behind garbage containers for those who feel more comfortable being invisible about it. And then, of course, there is a certain visibility that arrived with us joining social media.
Right.
For its visibility to be also a spectral to what we actually need to do in order to maintain the paper and our labor financially, namely selling advertisement.
Okay.
And taking care of media partnership with selected institutions and projects. So we sell ads, and sometimes we get donations, and sometimes we manage to be selected if we apply for funding. So, you know, I don't know, there are countless applications that we've done that were rejected because they don't consider us fundable enough.
Yeah. I've been there. Yes. I understand.
You know, I don't know, the vocabulary wasn't right. You know, we were not tackling the keywords, or we were not precise with the with our budget or quote unquote business model. I don't know. But we've been learning how to deal with this. We have a wonderful team that has also the experience of also navigating those structures and making a financial basis possible.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that with that funding, you're able to pay writers, or are writers doing it voluntarily?
So we've been paying everyone since day one. The first issue was paid through a specific funding that came from all places, from the BMW,
okay,
through a fiscal partner, which was Savvy Contemporary, a laboratory of practices and ideas. And back then, they were so kind to support us with that frame, since we were only two people running it, right?
Wow.
So we managed to pay the print, and even though I think there were 50 euros per contribution, what we managed to do and to pay ourselves something symbolic. Now we can allow ourselves to pay for contributions according to length. So for the first time since 6 years, we have admitted to ourselves that we need volunteers to help us. So this year is the exception, with contributions that will not be paid. But also we try to see how to compensate that, since we believe nothing is for free.
And how about you as a body? I always like to ask my guests, when did you become a working body?
Yes, I really loved this question. It's funny because I've liked to work since very young. I think I was 13 and I was already doing my first internship in a radio station.
Oh.
So I don't know, I come also from a family of hard workers in Ecuador. So I was so inspired by the political work that my grandfather would do, who was a founding member of the Izquierda Democrática, which is like the democratic left, funny name, for a party in the 70s. But I think that was the tone of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was... Yeah, I started working then. I think labor was for me something that was not necessarily jointly connected to payment. I think there was something that I would always like to do. So that back then, of course, as a child, you don't understand the implications of that and the exploitation you are experiencing. But I was just so driven by an eagerness and curiosity, and how do journalists work? And I think even in this naivety, I think I encountered journalists that did this not only for a living, a precarious living, but also passionate about being a vessel for information, for important information, for reporting and giving a nuanced perspective to politics. So I think I joined that collective body of labor on that age, and I think I never left it. So
did you feel like it was creative labor? How did you think of yourself in relation to creativity or into art?
I think it's a vocation. I think it's a outer body experience. There's yeah.
You mean journalism itself, or this radio internship, or?
I think it wasn't when telling this to you. I think I tell this for the first time. I'm not thinking of the internship, and I'm not necessarily thinking about the radio station, but rather. Or journalism, but rather being a vessel of communication, of information myself. Mm-hmm. So this is just like a piece on a bigger collective of a bigger picture. I think that, yeah, that stayed with me.
Yeah, I often think about just the political power of having a microphone, or having some kind of platform or amplification power, and like what that means.
Yeah, but I never thought it was about me. And I still don't think this is a personal thing. The work that we do on Arts of the Working Classes, or at least the working ethos that we share with my colleagues, is that it's just not about us. It's about something else. And it's that might be the pursuit to find social justice, but also the joy of doing it and looking for it through an aesthetic experience, but also through historical awareness, through practices of others, through creative joy, intellectual joy, and that this is not only reserved for a privileged class, for a ruling class, which has been, at least in the history books, dealt with or represented this way, or even now, still a struggle to find also ways of formulating this joy as something that is beyond classes or a specific social order or cultural order, that intellectual and aesthetic joy can be something bigger. So back then, we were working with Alina Collard. Paul, Alina, and I would sit and share with us the moment where we started to work within the arts or think within the arts. We just realized we all three had our first encounter with the arts on the streets. It was rather an opera singer on a street corner in Austria, where Alina grew up, or me waiting for my mother to get out of the bank, and I would wait in the library next door and find the catalog of Impressionist painters and be just overwhelmed by what I was looking at. Or Paul would just read stuff on the street and connect it in the most poetic way. And we consider this pivotal moment in every human's life.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That are constantly underestimated. I think Alina wrote also a piece back then. It was such a language that was intertwined with childhood memory, daily life observations, and an academic upbringing. And it's interesting to look at that, at least for me as an Ecuadorian in Germany, passing through also experience of migration, but also embedded in this pursuit of, I don't know, making my parents on the other side of the world proud that all the hard work that they did was worth for me to work or do whatever I wanted, right? And I think this is also a very specific migrant experience that we share with a lot of people that not only live in Berlin, or in cities where cultural wealth is concentrated. You know, in Ecuador, I think the first time I visited a museum was outside of the country.
Mm. Were you living in a city?
I was living in the city, but the places for culture were either, and I would like to be also careful with what I'm saying right now, but they were just not, they were dormant within also a certain kind of political agenda that would just diminish everything that was regarded to the cultural bagage. Yeah, so basically museums or institutions of education and knowledge, not only museums but also libraries, were just inaccessible when I was living in Ecuador. So this is slowly changing, but the administrations in power back then, they were just, they didn't give a damn. And the cultural and art workers were just basically doing what was possible. So the places where I would insert myself in were also very precarious places. Small theaters, filmotheques. So I guess precarity was always the frame, or culture was always embedded in a form of precarity for me. I grew up in a place where nobody was really interested in arts, or nobody had really that education. So the first encounters are in the streets. I happened to find the right people to have these conversations. We were Paul and Alina, and Halle Frost came along. Dalia Maini came with an Erasmus internship and ended up staying with us for years. She's now the current editor-in-chief. And we just shared the same vibrations when when it comes to all the unspeakable, or everything that remains invisible and still accompanies our perception of culture and the arts when we do the paper.
What was your feeling of coming to Germany and being in migration, a body in migration?
Mm-hmm. I think I was in shock for years, not really knowing what the fuck I was supposed to do, but rather try to finish my studies and start, I don't know. I think there's a word, there's three spaces. It's like, first is like, just finish this and leave. The second was to understand that there was the mid-2000s, so there was no vocabulary available, nor ways in which people will interact with each other that would be as inclusive as today, even though if today is still difficult for most of migrants, regardless in which conditions or the relative privileges in which you arrive to a certain country or not. It's just getting worse for many. But back then it was just, you felt just seen as a flat rate human being that was just a stranger or an exotic. I can't believe I'm saying this, but yes. yes, it was all the cliches, all the way. But I remained always patient, and for some reason also tried not to let too much anger drive me, but rather soft ways in which I could just like set aside the ways in which people just consciously or unconsciously are putting you in the role of the oppressed, in the role of the of what history has given to non-white bodies. And yeah, I think for too many years I remained silenced about that, but that has happily changed.
I'm understanding that you feel that you can be more vocal or outspoken, or that there's more spaces to speak about the racism that you incurred when you first came here.
Well, it's not only being vocal. It's just also about sharing the space with others. I think that's the most important part, to be in the space, to embrace the space, to make space for oneself and others. I think that is something that now it's so much easier, but not only for what has changed for myself, but actually what has changed also through the struggle and the work of others. And especially in Germany, there are tons of wonderful people who have done this job from the experience of being either children of migrants, children of guest workers, scholars themselves, activists taking the space and precipitating that possibility for those who have remained silent for too long. And from this example set is what Arts of the Working Class can be also meaningful. And this is what I think is the most rewarding. It remains ambivalent, you know. It's not that now everything is better. I think it's just different.
With the languages in the newspaper, it challenges the hegemony of English as a sort of common migrant language. And I feel like in that way, it gives more space to silenced voices in the city. Mm-hmm. I'm also curious if you feel also that the newspaper is addressing the intersection of race and class as well, and in what ways it does that.
Mm-hmm. The paper is the result of situated and embodied knowledge. I think their truths have been said and struggles are as old as we know. And this is just now also getting more and more plural. So we do look for voices to manifest themselves, but we're not necessarily saying something new, and we're aware of that. We are also interested in letting the complexity and the ambivalences that are necessary to not let polarization or resentment to take too much space. I think we do try to be a soft space, a space of plurality, and that means that epistemologies are constantly being resolved or formulated again by those who are participating in each issue. So there is maybe not a clear way in how the paper is intersectional for many. And I'm saying this because while I'm talking to you, I have the critique that it's also very important to me that I read sometimes that the paper is predominantly made by academics, but that it's just not true. It's people who feel encouraged or empowered through a specific language, a theoretical one, that try to also use in order to embody specific struggles. These are micro stories, mostly, that can be read as anachronistic too. We're not reporting, we're not a news channel in that sense, but rather, a paper that invites you to linger in the lives of others, mostly lives that are filled with struggle. And these can be very different ones. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I noticed when it came onto the streets, in part because I found that whether it was strategic or not, the branding of it and the writing in it appealed to, in a sense, to like a gentrifier class that was moving in a very international group of people that, for better or for worse, but that might, I mean, strategically might be interested in buying the paper for the paper and not just only in supporting the vendor, where I think it's like past other newspapers. But this one was really an object of also interesting journalism that I think was a game changer for the readership.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Yes, we hear this also as a point of critique quite a lot, that this is just appealing to maybe a certain, you know, to expats mostly. But this is truly made for everyone. And beautiful things appeal to a lot of people. And I think that this is the kind of social and critical commentary that we allow ourselves to put together is coming from, yes, different places, and not only a place of sorrow. I think this is also the mental states in which we invite people to be when reading this. It's just a certain form of alertness, but an awareness, but at the same time of just joy and pleasure. And I think this is just irritating. How can this both be possible at the same time? And I do feel that people feel the irritation and first struggle with it a little bit more than necessary.
Can you expand what you mean by the irritation?
I will use an analogy. So like maybe like the first time you are hallucinating and you want this to stop. And not until the moment where you just relax, you can just laugh out loud and just like enjoy what you're looking at, enjoy what you are seeing or feeling. Hallucination on acid or... Yeah, I think that would be an analogy I would choose.
This year, I'm really trying to focus on dreams and goals. And I know in this past issue, there was... Mm-hmm. Talk of the Artwork Summit, I believe, in October of 2023. And I'm curious what mm-hmm. kind of joys and dreaming came out of that. Were you there?
Yes.
Or what kind of joys and dreaming are you thinking mm-hmm. of for workers?
There were so many nice contributions. One of them was by the artist Dina Freimuth El-Kaisi, who invited everyone to sit on a rug and have a Zoom call with her mom and to talk about Egyptian deities and how embrace and community can look like based on the relationship between Dina and her mother, not only through motherhood, but also through certain female power that they were embracing in a way that was at first, again, irritating. It's like it was also a language that was also very spreaded like mine, but it was just so nice. In a total contrast to maybe the intervention by Alexander Koch, who is an artist and a theorist and community organizer through what is called the Nouveau Commanditaires, or the quote-unquote new patrons, which is an organization that wants citizens, non-citizens living in a very specific place to decide what kind of art should be placed in the public spheres, and not politicians nor just a specific boards to decide what that should be, but rather the people themselves. And this is a form of utopia that it's also very nerdy and bureaucratic and also very European. This is very difficult maybe to transport to other societal infrastructures, but it is definitely an utopia that it's worth understanding. How can it be implied in a capitalist society that is not going to change, but just getting worse? It is getting worse, and we all know that. So how do we really open up, hallucinate about what is happening to us and try to come out with something surprising and nice? I think that is, I think that is something that it's more inspiring to me these days, is to think mm-hmm. that, to think of ways of not escaping anymore, but or just to embracing the situation as it is, as brutal as that also might be as a statement. And I guess this paper is made out of that. Or I don't know how it sounds to you, but I feel very sad and funny at the same time when I say this.
Yeah, I mean, yes, because I feel often a real deep frustration around the amount of work that has to be done for survival. And so it's hard to find mm-hmm. joy in that. And I think I count myself among the lucky as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Even though I'm living precariously.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of different kinds of precarity. This 99% mm-hmm. is really diverse.
Sure. Yes. Well, the 99% is not necessarily the precarious class. I mean, the 1% are the billionaires, but, you know.
Right.
And then there's the rest.
Right, right, absolutely.
We have a few wealthy people within the 99.
True.
So, I don't know. I think there's this obsession of many also on radical scenes that there must be just one form or like the most pristine form of equality. The only thing to be pursued is something that I feel very skeptical about, even though I like it. I like to dream that, but it's also, I want to be happy in spite of my own poverty, financial poverty. I think there is a wealth that can be enjoyed differently too. It's about juggling and a lot of uncertainty, but yeah, there is a form of satisfaction that I'm starting to crave for. And I guess Art of the Working Class is a form of that kind of manifestation. It's like the satisfaction is, and I'm not gonna, and I'm not saying this is in the quote unquote little things. It's just, these are the big things. This is the big picture.
Yeah, I think as long as, I mean, that finding the joy and kind of even thriving off of the surprises that emerge from freelance life or from patchwork kinds of work makes very much sense to me. As long as one is getting enough sleep, in a way, I would say, or like be able to rejuvenate. I mean, I'm curious where you're.
Of course. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just curious where you're at as a working body.
Yes.
What you're busying yourself with and where you find, how you feel in your body.
Well, these days I'm visiting more doctors than usual just to also get my levels of stress and anxiety lowered. And I think that I'm just trying to be more conscious about that. Because everything that I'm telling you is just also outside of my body and outside of also my reality, I guess, through friends and family members and people that also demand from me some kind of normality standards. And I guess I'm just attending that.
You mean like showing up as a friend or a family member as opposed to a worker or?
Yes, I guess if I would have no responsibility towards friends and families around me, I would just work for Arts of the Working Class 24/7, you know. I'm just so convinced about this form of sharing that it's not charity, that it's just thriving. Yes, I've decided that this is not only that, this is also ways of not only showing up, but sometimes also responding to desires of those that are, who I love, and trying to balance it, balance my position in this world according to also them. There is some also joy I find in that. I think of the majority of people that have bullshit jobs that also try to do this. And I think, yeah, that makes me feel more connected to the working people, feeling that, yeah, honoring that no matter how meaningful we want things to be, that they are just not, and that's also fine.
Yeah, we can be really inside our heads, or we put our own meaning right into our into our work and interactions. I guess we project meaning onto them.
yes, but there is some ugliness in this. There is some yeah, also indescribable injustice in that. And that is also something to be embraced, in my opinion, in my humble opinion.
If you could think of future dreaming for workers in this city, what would that look like?
If that would be, I don't know, I think people should just work in joy and have a universal basic income to thrive and decide when to work and when not. And I think that societies can definitely work better that way, and that even though that it's just still just very far away from today.
Yeah, oh gosh, I dream of that so much too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's basically that, and that migration is embraced the same way as citizenship. I think if this could be of equal value and equal measure, that would be the best. No resentments. No more resentments to those who move differently. And in that sense, also the resentment towards those who live in without nothing on the streets deliberately goes also away.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic around the choice to live on the streets or to choose to use different kinds of services or be in shelters. I'm curious. I feel like I only kind of see what I see. I don't feel like I know or understand what's happening in Berlin vis-a-vis the unhoused. Yeah, I mean, I definitely see more people in tents. I've seen what seems to be more and more people sleeping outside in the last 20 years. What are your thoughts on this kind of this relationship between choosing or what's available, social services that are available to the unhoused right now in Berlin?
Yeah, this this labor should be better paid. The care has been always undermined. There's not enough payment for social workers. You know, that is the first thing that should change. Those who can, those who have the means and the tools and the willingness to help others should be best remunerated. And there are so many different models how to tackle that. But Germany is just very far away from that still. And there are no structures that allow for more more reciprocal ways of giving. And this is just so general, but I think there are too many Altenheim and there are too many places where people are forced to live alone. And I don't think that makes sense at all. I think we all have to, use space more differently, more freely, and take care of each other. And those who don't want that, it's also absolutely fine. As long as you don't, as long as you can also give, that's fine. And if you cannot, then society should also tolerate you in your decision of having nothing and just wandering around. And I think this is also what would also make the cities less hostile, and the BVG should also get its stations cleaner and invest in exactly that. So people who linger there feel just way more comfortable. I think social structures should be there for that, just to linger and enjoy them. But I don't know what is going on in that sense. I know just too little. But I wish that Hermannplatz and Schönleinstraße could be just more livable for those who like to live there.
You just heard from editor and curator Maria Inés Plazo Lazo, who in 2018 founded, together with Paul Zohatsky, the multilingual street newspaper for art and society, wealth and poverty, called Arts of the Working Class. You can read more about her and some of the things we mentioned in the show notes. I'm Mad Kate, and you've been listening to Sweat, a series of conversations about performance and performativity of the sexual and sexualized body and work. The theme music was composed by me and features the voice of performer and actress Lori Baldwin. Sweat airs every second Tuesday of the month at 13 hours Central European Time on Collaboradio, Free Radio's Berlin Brandenburg, broadcasting on 88.4 FM in Berlin, 90.7 FM in Potsdam, and streaming online at fr-bb.org. Afterwards, it's available for streaming wherever you get your podcasts. Sweat is an unpaid labor of love. If you have the means to financially support the show, you'll find a link to my Patreon in the show notes. Your support is warmly appreciated.